So our job as Russian patriots, and this is what I call upon my compatriots to do all the time, is to be mobilized and be active in defending Russia. Some people, they think, oh, well, you know, assimilation and so forth, and we can't do much to help Russia. We believe that it's not enough just to be Russian. You must support Russia. You must actively support Russia, and you should defend Russia.
In 2021, the ABC's Four Corners aired an episode called Putin's Patriots, which looked at Russian groups such as the Australian Cossacks. You just heard from leader Semyon Boykov there, who is these days living inside Russia's Sydney consulate to escape arrest. Another was a gang called the Night Wolves. It's a Kremlin-linked, far-right Russian motorcycle club that has a chapter in Australia. My next guest is a specialist in how Russia uses not only the online world, but how boots-on-the-ground communities like these are used to assert political influence. Dr. Olga Boychak is Senior Lecturer in Digital Cultures at the University of Sydney. Thanks for being here, Olga. Just tell us, who are the Night Wolves and how active are they globally?
The Night Wolves are a motorcycle club, but unlike the other motorcycle clubs that have this kind of countercultural nature to them, they started as one, but soon they evolved into pretty much mouthpieces of the Kremlin. So they started back in before the fall out of the Soviet Union in the late 80s, and they really were inspired by the other motorcycle clubs like Hell's Angels, like the Bandidos. But very soon they kind of switched, and they started being ardent supporters of Vladimir Putin. So after Vladimir Putin became president of the Russian Federation for the first time in 2020, they were seen on many different events supporting Vladimir Putin, that they were organizing rides to support Dmitry Medvedev. And in that way, they kind of became those mouthpieces of the Russian propaganda. They now have over 65 chapters in Russia. They have chapters almost all around the world, including a few chapters here in Australia. And the main things that they have been noticed or involved in is basically propagating Russian influence in their countries of operation. They've also been noticed in orchestrating pro-Russian insurgencies in various places. So that is what they're occupied with in the current moment.
And they gained some notoriety, didn't they, back in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea?
Absolutely. And that is a very interesting story because it starts many years before Russia occupied Crimea. It starts probably in 2010s, if not earlier. So in 2010, they were known to organize various events, particularly working with youth in Crimea. They were organizing things like concerts, things like summer camps, where they did some patriotic education of the young people in Crimea. And so in a way, that became sort of a premonition that has set the fertile ground for the subsequent Russia's annexation of Crimea. And that is, in a way, positions them as almost those riders of the apocalypse or riders of the things that might be yet to come.
Tell us why the European Union has sanctioned some members.
For a number of reasons. There might be some legal reasons to sanction individual members, but on a broader scale, because their work in propagating the Russian influence has been considered a security threat. And that is the reason why some of their rides, so they have an annual ride celebrating victory, but framed in a very particular way. So they're celebrating Russia's victory over fascism, and they have this joyride where they attend kind of all of the significant places where battles took place, and they commemorate and celebrate basically the Russian contribution to defeating fascism. But what is really important here is that in their interpretation, fascism is a feature, is exhibited by those who are Russia's enemies. And by that logic, anyone who is the enemy of Russia in the contemporary time is a fascist.
So I guess we really need to point out that they haven't been outlawed or sanctioned here in Australia, although they have been in the US and Canada.
Yes, and I think that still provides some room for maneuver. But I think what is so interesting in the Night Wolves and in many other similar cultural or countercultural communities linked to the Russian Federation is that they act as sort of micro-influencers in the political space. So influencers are well known in the kind of marketing space, right? They are increasingly used by companies to sell us different products. And in politics, they've increasingly been employed to propagate political views, political values, political beliefs. And this is something that is really interesting because in this space, the more authentic an actor, the more believable they are, the more their audience wants to emulate them. And they become these really natural spokespersons, if you will. And what is also really, there is an interesting paradox with influencing when it comes to authenticity, because the more followers an influencer has, the less authentic they are perceived to be. And I think each and every one of us has encountered this phenomenon in our own social media circles. The more kind of people we have following us, the less freely we can speak, the more kind of the less authentic we may seem. And so this is where some of those micro-influencers, people who don't really have large followerships, people who have under 10,000 followers, are really effective in spreading some of the messages because they take them as their own and they're perceived by their audience as authentic. And so this is what Russia increasingly uses to propagate its political influence in Western democracies in particular, is these kinds of boots on the ground, but also using them as communicative actors to propagate those ideas and beliefs.
Do you think all of them are directly linked with the Russian state, or do some of them, as we heard in the grab at the beginning, do some of them just feel that because they are Russians, they have this duty and they end up doing the work of the state without necessarily being state-sanctioned operatives?
I think it can be both. I think it wouldn't be right to claim that every Russian patriot, as they call themselves, are necessarily, you know, on a Russian paycheck. And I do think that people join and become propagators or Russian supporters for multiple reasons. But I do think that with regard to the Russian diaspora, it's really interesting to think about those things because the Russian diaspora is known to assimilate. And this is something that makes them very different from many other national communities, which really maintain and support their identity when they move overseas. With the Russian diaspora, that is not a straightforward phenomenon. So a lot of them try to, join the country in which they live in ways to kind of not develop and not foster their Russianness. So this explicit desire to be proudly Russian at a time when Russia is committing horrendous war crimes in Ukraine, when Russia is involved in many other things, I think it just begs a question. So that is all.
Mm. Do you characterize the Australian Cossacks in the same way as the Knight Riders?
They are surely an interesting community. They are a political actor. They are involved in perhaps in some of the networks of pro-Russian actors. I think now that Semyon Boykov is in the Russian consulate, I think they are still active. So a few days ago, I think it was the 11th of June, I was actually on my way from work riding a bus. And I remember looking out the window and seeing a giant face of Vladimir Putin looking back at me. And it was a bit of a surreal experience because I didn't know what to think of it. But I realized those were large billboards with Vladimir Putin's face plastered all over them that were driving past the bus, so just driving on the street. And then I saw that they were part of an information campaign, information operation, if you will, where a lot of them were driving through Sydney and being photographed at the backdrop of our key landmarks. So they were photographed right next to the Harbour Bridge. They were photographed right next to the Opera House. And those photos that were taken by these communities have been used in those operations. So they were shown to the domestic audience in Russia saying, look, you know, we can do whatever we want in Australia. Here's one of our, you know, acts. And then they were also used to foster maybe Australian public support, showing that there are those who support what Russia is doing and kind of normalizing the support for Russia in public spaces.
So one of the ways in which you say Russia tries to exert political and cultural influence is through promoting the Russian poet Alexander Pushkin. Explain how they use his work.
Yes, so it is not only through promoting Pushkin, it is overall through the promotion of Russian culture. And it's often coupled with the adjective great. So oftentimes we encounter the phrase great Russian culture, which I think should be suspicious on its own, just the way that it's kind of framed. So the great Russian culture, the sort of classical Russian culture, that would be Pushkin, that would be Dostoevsky, that would be Ballet, that would be Tchaikovsky. So all of the kind of things that traditionally are associated with Russia are have been for many years and are increasingly used to promote Russian cultural influence. And I think it is really done with a strategic purpose. And the strategic purpose is to promote a narrative that Russians are very civilized people, that they that their culture is very sophisticated, and that creates this uncomfortable duality. Because at the time when Russian atrocities have, you know, come to the fore, when they've been well documented, when there we know what has been happening in the territories, Ukraine's territories that are currently occupied by Russia, and at the same time there is this high kind of definition of culture, and so this duality, pretty much what it says is you know, there is another Russia, there is this idealized vision of Russia, and then there's the Russia that's committing the war crimes. So in a way it's an attempt to whitewash some of the very real things that are happening right now and to distract people from discussing them.
Do you think people are not able to hold those two ideas at the one time? You know, some of the great art and music and writing that has come from Russian artists is real and exists. But at the same time, we understand what is happening in Ukraine. So one doesn't need to eliminate the other, does it?
I think I do think that they're connected, though, because Russian imperialism has really thrived while a lot of minority writers, writers coming from places that were occupied by the Russian Empire and then by the Soviet Union, they got seriously oppressed up until the point of a lot of them lost their lives because they were public intellectuals, because they were creators who, you know, were Ukrainian or were belonging to one of the other minorities that were part of the Soviet Union. So I think this realization, this reckoning that the great Russian culture actually became so at the cost of a lot of other, you know, no less great authors and artists who could have perhaps produced also some really great works of art that we could now be admiring, is something that I wish people thought more about. And I can provide an example. So Ukraine's genius, Taras Shevchenko, he was a polymath. He was an artist who lived in the early and mid-19th century. And so pretty much when Leo Tolstoy was finishing his War and Peace, was submitting it for publication, Shevchenko died after he was, you know, he was sent to labor camps for almost 20 years that ruined his health. And so I think this contrast of someone who was so capable, who had so much potential, who could produce and did produce, he was a human rights activist, he was an artist, a painter, a poet, he had friends all over Europe at the time, he was a fashion icon, he was so many things that just never came to be because of the oppression that he experienced. And I like to think of that as one of the stories in how, you know, that allowed Russian culture to be kind of raised on this pedestal. And I often think about it when I think of Russian culture.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm Tracy Holmes, filling in for David Marr, and I'm speaking with Russian disinformation expert Olga Boychak. Olga, tell us also about Vladimir Zelensky's new decolonization legislation. Or it's not that new anymore, I think was put in place in 2023. But how that has worked in pulling down, you know, monuments and memorials and these sorts of things.
Well, I think it's not necessarily coming from Zelensky, but it's also more of a grassroots phenomenon. I was actually an active participant of the Revolution of Dignity that happened in 2013 and 14, and I was present in Kyiv when people took down Lenin's monument. And I thought that was such a powerful historical moment of really unprompted people just realizing that Lenin is a marker of colonial oppression, that Lenin has no place in contemporary Kyiv, you know, in a prominent Bessarabska square. And so I think a lot of these, the taking down of monuments, of especially Russian markers of colonial identity, and Pushkin being very prominent among them, is a very much a grassroots phenomenon. People are trying to reclaim some of their lost history. They're trying to maybe pay more attention and elevate some of their own, you know, who they consider national heroes, some of their own creatives and artists who oftentimes even we don't know much about, because even in some museums around the world, they have long been considered Russian or Soviet. And that was also a way to erase kind of their Ukrainian identity, their contribution to Ukrainian culture. And I think overall, when we think of the role that Pushkin plays in establishing this colonial domination in the contemporary time, it's actually quite chilling. So when Mariupol, the city in the south of Ukraine, was occupied by the Russians, the Mariupol Drama Theater was one of the big places where people sheltered during the early days of the occupation. And there were between 300 and 500 people who were sheltering in the drama theater. They had a large word "children" written in the square in front of the theater, just to show, you know, if the planes are flying overhead, to kind of mark that theater as a place where civilians were sheltering. And it got obliterated from above. And this place of a mass atrocity, of a mass tragedy, Russia didn't keep it that way. Right now, the Mariupol Drama Theater has been rebuilt, and recently it had the first show that was shown in that theater. But what was really striking was that as it was rebuilt, as the scaffolding was erected around it, there were huge Pushkin's portraits all over that building. And so Pushkin tends to show up in the places that experienced a lot of violence, a lot of colonial violence, where it had to be erased and obscured and covered up. And so this is what really bothers me, is just understanding how Pushkin is used and how he's perceived, you know, our ability to celebrate him at the same time. So there was a cultural performance celebrating Pushkin at the Opera House recently, and I thought that was really, you know, somewhat tone deaf.
Yeah, so you're saying that, you know, these same sorts of using these sorts of things is happening right here in Australia too?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's happening all the time, and it is happening through many different cultural genres and formats. It could be happening through Russian film, you know, showing, for example, showing Russian documentaries that were filmed in the occupied territories of Ukraine, where we know that no journalists have access to. So they were filmed by someone who was sanctioned and approved by the Russian Federation to be there. So a lot of these cultural events, they might not have a direct connection to Russia, but in promoting the Russian culture, they, you know, it's just a really problematic thing to do in the contemporary time when Ukrainian culture is being extinguished, because literally the people who are the creators of that culture are being murdered.
Olga, these organizations that you've been talking about, and how they use Russian culture and get a message out there, even in a micro-influential way, have any of them been investigated by the Australian government for foreign interference, or is it just speculation?
Not that I'm aware of. I do not have any knowledge of them being investigated. I think this is very much an internal matter. I do not think they are violating any laws in Australia in particular, at least not that I've heard of. I do know that Semyon Boykov had some, he had assaulted an Australian citizen, so I know that much. But overall, I am not aware of any organizations being implicated.
When we look at the war more broadly, there seems to be significant discontent at the moment with Zelensky. And I imagine that many people are just sick and tired of the war. They want the war to end. That's not Zelensky's fault, but it has an impact at home, doesn't it? He's recently sacked his defence minister. But how do you see what's playing out in Ukraine at the moment?
Well, people are definitely tired of the war, but that doesn't mean that, they want the war to end on just terms. Capitulation is not a victory, and so everyone understands that really well. And so no matter how hard it might get, last winter was one of the hardest ones to survive. It takes a lot of courage and resilience and, I guess, bravery to live through a European winter in a big city and also in other areas without, when Russia was relentlessly bombing Ukraine's key energy infrastructure, when Ukraine was literally, left without heat, without light. It is pretty incredible how people managed to survive, and not only survive, but also extend support to those around them. And so I remember reading an account of a woman who was freezing in her apartment in the middle of the winter, and she was talking about every time that she, that she felt like she was about to complain about her conditions and about the war and being, growing fatigued and tired. She just remembered about, the soldiers at the front lines trying to prevent Russian occupation, trying to repeal the Russian army. And so her way of channeling her rage and her helplessness was to purchase a set of thermal underwear and send it over to the battlefront. And so she said, there are those who need it more than me, and I'm going to keep doing it as a way of resisting this. And so I think, there has been incredible resilience, which is not a very good way of portraying it, because people are really tired and they're vulnerable. But in a way, they understand that if they get occupied by Russia, the world has seen what Russian occupation means. And I think everyone understands really well that as long as, Ukraine stands, people will be able to continue exercising their democratic governance. And I think what we're seeing, the popular protests in Ukraine at the moment, are very much indicative and illustrative of that civic spirit, where people agree to, they go to protest against something, this is essentially about government's accountability. And they do this at a risk to their own lives. But this is really important. And this is exactly the political culture that Vladimir Putin is so afraid of and that he wants to exterminate.
We know that elections are still on hold in Ukraine because of the war. Are you getting a sense of what might happen when that next election is held?
I think it is a complicated question, exactly because it is not possible to hold elections right now. And so this is a bit of a paradox where, no matter how much people might want the elections to take place, it would still not be feasible or possible or practical or safe to, and it would also not be constitutional to organize them currently in Ukraine. So I think Ukraine resorts to other governance mechanisms that, would allow, change to take place. The current conflict between the Minister of Defense and the Ukrainian Armed Forces chief is unfortunate because Ukraine really benefits from unity at this historical moment in time. And so this is something that hopefully will be resolved soon. But as we see from historical examples, it's really fraught to be changing hands, to appoint a new minister at a time when they would really need to learn on the fly. And so, yes, that definitely presents risks that creates, that kind of misunderstandings create a dangerous precedent for Ukraine, and hopefully that can be resolved soon, just not to undermine all of the remarkable efforts that Ukraine is involved in.
So President Zelensky is in Washington at the moment and has just held meetings with President Trump and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Has that had any significant outcome for the war effort?
Not at this point. We know that they had some agreements. Right now, what is at stake is Ukraine being able to produce the Patriot interceptor systems, and that is one of the things that I know has been discussed. The reason for that is that the speed of producing those interceptor systems and overall the stockpile of weapons is dwindling, and it's dwindling really rapidly, especially with what is happening in the Middle East. So I do think that if Ukraine were to gain those capabilities, it would really allow Ukraine to provide air defense, because I know that is a major issue. There are the attacks by Russia on Ukrainian civilians. They get worse and worse, and every time it is harder to imagine what might be a worse attack, and yet they intensify. There are more weapons used. There are different kinds of weapons used. And so the Patriot missiles are really, the Patriot interceptor systems are really one of the things that can provide the security Ukraine needs, particularly with regard to civilians.
Yes, well, we talk a lot about the war effort, but it seems a conversation without an end, sadly. One hopes that it does happen sooner rather than later. Olga, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tracy.
That's Dr. Olga Boychak, Senior Lecturer in Digital Cultures at the University of Sydney. She's a media sociologist who explores how communities can build resilience when digital technologies are weaponized.